like Rome, India, and Istanbul. It seems that they are only mentioned in some Sunni sources. For example, in Al-Fitan, page 238, we read, عَلَى يَدَيْ ذَلِكَ الْخَلِيفَةِ الْيَمَانِ وَفِي وِلَايَتِهِ تُفْتَحُ رُومِيَّةِ. Rome will be conquered at the time of Yamani, when he is the ruler. In another narration, we read that Yamani will conquer Istanbul and Rome, and he also will have a war in India. So these narrations are not mentioned from the Imam of the Ahlul Bayt, and we cannot rely on them. And the other point is that these narrations are contradicting some of the narrations which attribute these points to Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
Yeah.
I mean, he will conquer these places. Again, another point to reject these narrations. And the next point is that to do such a great deeds to conquer such a places is in need of great armies and, facilities and so on and so forth.
Which means it still not be in the hands of Yamani.
Exactly. So it's very unlikely to claim that Yamani would be able to conquer all these.
So have we reached a point that Yamani will not necessarily conquer the places like Rome, India, and Istanbul? We'll discuss more what will happen, the series of events, in the upcoming sessions. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to the IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Saudi Arabia in the world of politics.
Part 3.
In recent years, Saudi Arabia has been the largest buyer of arms in the world and is making great efforts to continue on its path. At the same time, it is trying to start a coalition of its friends, especially the Arab countries, against Iran.
Talk is cheap. Let's look at the actions. Saudis helped Saddam Hussein for 8 years. Saudis helped Al-Qaeda. Saudis created Daesh. Saudis created al-Nusra. So they started this sectarian message, not us.
Nonsense. The Iranians are the ones who are exporting terrorism. They're the ones who are stoking the fires of sectarianism. They're the ones who are violating international laws and norms and acceptable behavior. And they're the ones who have been on an aggressive path since 1979.
Despite the fact that the United States and almost every other powerful nation supports Saudi Arabia actively and tries to undermine us actively, we are still the most influential power in the Middle East. That should tell you something. That should tell you that we have made the right choices and they've made the wrong choices.
King Faisal was assassinated by one of the Saudi princes on April the 1st of 1975. This worried all the allies of the Saudi family, especially the King of Iran.
Almost a month later, in May of 1975, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi visited the new king of Saudi Arabia, King Khalid, to indicate the relations with that country were important to him. But no one knew that it was the last visit of the Pahlavi king to Saudi Arabia, and the next victim of the world of politics would be him. The initial reaction of the Saudi officials to the victory of the Islamic Revolution can be called a conservative one. King Khalid, in his first reaction, called the establishment of an Islamic government in Iran a prelude to greater rapprochement and understanding between the two countries. 3 months after the victory of the revolution in April of 1979, a Saudi delegation traveled to Iran. Simultaneously with the occupation of Masjid al-Haram, an unforeseen event in the eastern region of Saudi Arabia made the Saudi rulers angry with Iran. Shias in this area marched on the day of Ashura, demanding their civil rights while they were holding pictures of Imam Khomeini. The Saudi rulers, who were still involved in the occupation of Masjid al-Haram, reacted harshly to the incident, which resulted in 24 deaths on the day of Ashura in 1979. In June of 1985, the Saudi foreign minister visited the Islamic Republic of Iran for the first time. Saud al-Faisal's agenda was to improve the ties between the two countries and to encourage Iran to conduct peace negotiations with Iraq. In the same year, Iranian Foreign Minister Ali Akbar Velayati also visited Saudi Arabia. It did not bring much development in the relations between the two countries, but reduced the spread of tension. Shortly after the end of the Iraq-Iran war, Arab countries demanded repayment of the money they had given to Saddam during the war, and Kuwait was at the forefront of these creditors. Iraq's Ba'athist regime, which considered itself to be the representative of the Arab world against Iran, refused to repay its debt. Saddam also called for a reduction in oil production by Arab countries so that he could rebuild the ruins of war by raising oil prices, a request that was opposed by Arab countries, especially Kuwait. The continuation of tensions led to Saddam's invasion of Kuwait on August 2nd of 1990, an event that shocked the whole world, especially the Arab friends of the Ba'athist regime. The Iraqi army even crossed Kuwait and entered the Saudi city of Al-Khafji. The continuation of this campaign could seriously endanger the flow of oil from the Persian Gulf. Shortly after the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, its war machine shifted to Iraq. With the U.S.-led coalition attack, the Ba'athist regime, controlled by Saddam Hussein, was overthrown, something that had not happened even after the invasion of Kuwait. Now, Saudi Arabia felt that it had lost the game to Iran in two fronts.
This was central Baghdad today, as Saddam Hussein's regime finally lost control.
The statue of Saddam Hussein.
Iran had important enemies on the other side of both its eastern and western borders that had now fallen, and Saudi Arabia was not pleased with this victory and the change of balance of power by the United States. In the years that followed, the victories of Iran steadily increased. For Saudi Arabia, which has always tried to play a leading role in the Islamic world, the issue of Palestine was very important. Iran's support of the resistance movement against the Israeli Zionist regime created an axis that is known as Axis of Resistance. In addition to armed struggle, these groups were engaged in political activities in Lebanon and Palestine, and they could also gain some achievements. In July of 2006, Israel launched a land, sea, and air war against Lebanon, which continued for 33 days. The pretext for this war was the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah's operation of capturing Israeli forces on the southern border of Israel with the occupied Palestine in order to exchange the captives with its forces who were in Israeli prisons. At the same time, a similar event took place in the Gaza Strip against the Palestinian Hamas movement. The position of Saudi Arabia and some Arab countries during the days of the war was very hostile towards the resistance groups. Egypt, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia were serious critics of Lebanon's Hezbollah and accused it of adventurism, which its Secretary General Syed Hassan Nasrallah responded to in the very first days of the war. Israel, which had ended all previous wars by occupying parts of the Arab lands, failed in this war and did not achieve any of the goals announced in the early days of the war, an issue that even many Zionist leaders acknowledged. The end of the war in Lebanon and the Gaza Strip was a new era in the struggle against Israel, which was met with the sympathy of many Islamic nations and even some non-Islamic countries. After the end of the 33-day war, a fact-finding committee was tasked with examining the performance of the Israeli cabinet and army in the war. According to their report, named the Vinaigrette, then Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert was announced as the culprit of Israel's defeat in the war and its failure to destroy Hezbollah, which was one of Israel's main goals on the first days of the war. Several attacks of the Zionist regime on the Gaza Strip in the following years and the resistance of Palestinian groups in the region had similar results for the Axis of Resistance. Saudi Arabia saw that Iran had found a decisive role in an important issue such as Palestine and, of course, was victorious in the field of Palestine. During these years, Saudi Arabia publicly expressed concern about the victories of Iran and its friends in the region, to the extent that it launched a media and propaganda campaign called the Struggle Against Creation of a Shia Crescent that turned into a public battle in many countries. The first arena was the formation of a bloody war in Iraq. The dramatic victories for Shia parties, which had good relations with Iran in various elections in the years that followed the fall of Saddam Hussein in Iraq, was a severe defeat for the rulers of Saudi Arabia as well as the U.S. Something needed to be done to stop these victories, and the creation of a religious war was Saudi Arabia's first choice. Al-Qaeda in Iraq, led by Abu Musab Zarqawi, started a bloody war in Iraq in which the main victims were civilians. All Iraqi cities were involved in a war for which no one could imagine an end. The explosion of Al-Askari Shrine in Samarra on June the 13th of 2007 escalated the conflicts in a way that 2006 and 2007 were the bloodiest years in Iraq after the fall of Saddam Hussein. Within these 2 years, dozens of people were brutally killed in different parts of Iraq every day. According to a research, nearly 60,000 people were killed in Iraq just in those 2 years.
Violence. violence is not raging rampantly across Iraq.
My view would be they've reached a stage of desperation from their standpoint.
So the country is not awash in sectarian violence.
Americans have never retreated in the face of thugs and assassins, and we will not begin now.
According to WikiLeaks reports, in the early days of the Iraq War, only 7 al-Qaeda-linked groups were active in the country. The number of these groups increased to hundreds at the end of 2008. Most of the commanders of these groups were trained in different parts of the world with the support of Saudi Arabia years ago before they moved to Iraq. Iran tried to help reduce violence through mediation in Iraq, and to that end, it formally negotiated with U.S. officials based in Baghdad for the first time. After these negotiations, violence was significantly reduced. But a few years later, some events unfolded again in the Arab world that shifted the political balance to the detriment of Saudi Arabia in the region. On December the 17th of 2010, a Tunisian greengrocer, Mohamed Bouazizi, living in the capital, set himself on fire in front of the city hall to protest the confiscation of his goods and being beaten by a police officer. The incident sparked a major uprising in the country that ended the 23-year rule of Zain al-Abidin bin Ali. Bin Ali, a close friend of Saudi Arabia, fled to the kingdom. But the story did not stop in Tunisia. The wave of this uprising spread like a domino over other Arab countries such as Egypt, Bahrain, Libya, and Yemen, countries whose leaders had been close friends of Saudi Arabia for years. Saudi Arabia worked to stop these defeats, attempts to host the fugitive leaders of these countries, and also sending troops to protect some others were among some of their measures during those days. But an important policy on the agenda of Saudi Arabia and its allies was to move the battlefield to Syria. Transferring all terrorist groups with a Takfiri view to Syria and granting them unprecedented military, financial, and political aids under the Saudi management began to overthrow the ruling government in Syria. No solutions for peace talks or negotiations could be found due to Saudi Arabia's acts of sabotage. A few years after the outbreak of the war in Syria, then U.S. Vice President Joe Biden, in a speech at Harvard University, made some bizarre remarks about the war and the role of U.S. allies in Syria.
What my constant cry was that our biggest problem is our allies. Our allies in the region were our largest problem in Syria. The Turks were great friends, and I have a great relationship with Erdogan, which I just spent a lot of time with. The Saudis, the Emiratis, etc. What were they doing? They were so determined to take down Assad and essentially have a proxy Sunni-Shia war. What did they do? They poured hundreds of millions of dollars and tens, thousands of tons of weapons into anyone who would fight against Assad. Except that the people who were being supplied were al-Nusra and al-Qaeda and the extremist elements of jihadis coming from other parts of the world. Now, you think I'm exaggerating? Take a look. Where did all of this go? So now what's happening? All of a sudden, everybody's awakened because this outfit called ISIL, which was al-Qaeda in Iraq, which when they were essentially thrown out of Iraq, found open space and territory in eastern Syria, work with al-Nusra, who we declared a terrorist group early on, and we could not convince our colleagues to stop supplying them.
But Iran's presence in this country, due to the request of the Syrian government, changed the equations. The years-long war in Syria is not over yet, but today, no one is talking about the overthrow of Bashar Assad. The next battlefield was Yemen, where Saudi Arabia's efforts to rebuild its desired government had failed. Saudi Arabia entered Yemen directly with the formation of a coalition of some Arab countries and armed support from Western countries. Riyadh, worried that Yemen's Ansarullah movement, which tends towards Iran and the Islamic Revolution, would become a political military group in the Yemeni power structure, like Hezbollah in Lebanon. Despite a comprehensive land, sea, and air blockade of Yemen since the beginning of the war, which made it impossible to even send humanitarian aid to the country, Saudi Arabia has been trying to accuse Iran of secretly providing financial, educational, and equipment assistance to the Ansarullah movement, the government based in Sana'a, and the Yemeni People's Committee. A claim that is even hard for Saudi friends to believe.
This is the kind of weapon the Iranian regime and the Iranian IRGC, they are using against the civilian object and the civilian infrastructure. They have attacked the Saudi in last May and also the several days ago, 4 days ago. This UAV is Iranian UAV, Delta Wing, and all the component that we have recovered and we have analyzed through our expert, it show the capability of the Iranian regime.
What is it about these missiles and UAVs that tell you specifically that they don't have the range to have been flown from Yemen?
The cruise missile cannot reach as we have put the ring, and it's not coming from Yemen. Those kind of attack is coming from the north with the capability that most likely from the north it can be launched from somewhere. And right now we are working to know exactly the launch point. I mean, your last point, please. Last point you mentioned.
Well, the last point was, how do you find, how are you finding that launch point?
As I mentioned, so we have a lot of way to find it and to spot it. And we got recovered a lot of information from the UAV itself. Some of the components here, the Iranian regime and the IRGC, they are trying to erase the information. However, we have collected the enough information and to know what's behind it. Thank you.
So is it Iran?
Thank you.
Is it Iran?
Thank you.
What do you...
Would you please...
Yes.
I am controlling the press conference. Have a seat, please. Please.
Thank you very much. Mark Stone from Sky News. With respect, this is quite an embarrassing display for the Saudi military, because it's quite clear that your air defences failed incredibly badly, that so many missiles and drones were able to penetrate deep into Saudi Arabia.
The recent decade has been the time of a cold war between Saudi Arabia and Iran. The coming to power of the new king, King Salman, and his arrangement of the pyramid of power increased tensions between the two countries. Many analysts considered the new crown prince, who was also the minister of defense, to be the most powerful person in the Saudi dynasty and the general designer of Saudi politics. In the days that we are making this documentary, 90 years have passed since the beginning of Iran-Saudi Arabia relations. The two countries have seen many ups and downs in their ties in all these years. And today, it is passing one of its most tense periods. Today, Saudi Arabia is very different from 90 years ago. The face of its cities has drastically changed. However, one thing still remains unchanged from the past century: Saudi Arabia's reliance on Kaaba and oil dollars. The story of relationships between Iran and Saudi Arabia is still ongoing. The story of two countries whose destinies are intertwined and their policies influence one another. The people of the future will also write about these days and the relationship.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The former U.S. President Donald Trump has released a sarcastic message to his Democratic political rivals on the occasion of Christmas. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Website Politico has covered the story. Former U.S. President Donald Trump has expressed his concerns in a Christmas Eve posting on his Truth Social platform, saying that the United States is dying from within. Donald Trump wrote on his Truth Social platform on Sunday, 25th of December, "On this very cold but beautiful Christmas day, look at our nation now on the southern border compared to only a short time ago during the Trump administration," characterizing current conditions as a horror show. The message followed one from Saturday, 24th of December, in which he expressed his version of goodwill to all, directing tidings to the radical left Marxists and the Department of Injustice and the lamestream media. Donald Trump said the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI, is illegally coercing the media to push for a mentally disabled Democrat who is President Joe Biden. He said in a series of Christmas messages, "Merry Christmas to everyone, including the radical left Marxists that are trying to destroy our country." The Federal Bureau of Investigation that is illegally coercing and paying social and lamestream media to push for a mentally disabled Democrat over the brilliant, clairvoyant, and USA-loving Donald J. Trump. And of course, the Department of Injustice, which appointed a special prosecutor who, together with his wife and family, hates Trump more than any other person on earth. Trump's predecessor, President Barack Obama, and his successor, President Joe Biden, also issued Christmas holiday messages. On Friday, 23rd of December, Trump had responded by video to the release of the 845-page final report of the House Select Committee investigating the 6th of January 2021 Capitol attack. Donald Trump said the American people have been deceived with lies about the 6th of January 2021 attack. The House Select Committee report said the central cause of 6th of January was one man, former President Donald Trump, whom many others followed. None of the events of 6th of January 2021 would have happened without him. The committee report followed criminal referrals to the Department of Justice from the 9-member committee. Trump said the House committee cut the part of his speech at the rally at the Ellipse preceding the unrest out in which he said demonstrators will be walking to the Capitol peacefully and patriotically. Trump has been casting doubt on the outcome of his loss by insisting it was the result of fraud. He said that the 2020 presidential election was the greatest election hoax in history. Donald Trump's claims have significantly delegitimized the democratic process in the United States. A recent opinion poll has found that at least 50% of Republican voters surveyed believe their vote will not be counted accurately the next time they cast a ballot. The Business Insider has also covered the same story and tells us more. In his first Christmas message on Saturday, 24th of December, former U.S. President Donald Trump did not elaborate on why he called himself clairvoyant, which means a person who claims to have a supernatural ability to predict future events. In his next message on Sunday, 25th of December, on Christmas Day, Trump focused on immigration at the southern border with Mexico, claiming that migrants were coming into the country at a rate never seen before. According to U.S. Customs and Border Protection data released on Christmas Eve, a record number of 2.4 million migrants were apprehended along the southern border with Mexico in the fiscal year ending on September 30th this year. Trump wrote, "On this very cold but beautiful Christmas day, look at our nation now on the southern border compared to only a short time ago during the Trump administration." He described the situation as a horror show and said, "Many of the migrants were criminals, including killers, human traffickers, and drug dealers." The number of migrants led to Trump's assessment that the USA is dying from within. Trump, who is running for president for the third time in 2024, won the 2016 election following a successful campaign, which included his signature promise to build a wall between US and Mexico to keep migrants out. Donald Trump followed that message with 6 more posts on Christmas Day, including one ending with, "Today, like never before, we're a nation in decline, a failing nation." Trump is currently facing multiple legal troubles, including a criminal investigation into his campaign's effort to overturn election results in Georgia in 2020, and a U.S. Justice Department investigation into the handling of government records. The House 6th of January panel also recently published its final report after a nearly 18-month probe into the attack and asked the Department of Justice to prosecute Donald Trump on 4 charges relating to the riot. Newsweek magazine has also covered the same story. Donald Trump chose to spend Christmas Day posting on Truth Social attacking President Joe Biden, saying the radical left Democrats are truly seeking to destroy America, and defend his time as president and his November midterm endorsements. In his first Truth Social post on 25th of December, Trump claimed, "Just 2 years ago, we were energy independent, had almost zero inflation, there was no war with Russia and Ukraine, would never have happened. Daesh was defeated, our military was rebuilt and respected before the disaster of Afghanistan, our border was strong, the economy was great, the coronavirus was in retreat, and we weren't the laughing stock of the world." Trump was still not finished with his Christmas Day social media post and once again attacked the radical left Democrats in a subsequent Truth Social post, charging them with having weaponized the criminal justice system at a level never seen before in the United States. "With no borders and crooked elections, our country is in the third world trouble." Donald Trump's seventh and final Christmas Day social media post saw him continue to push the claim that his former Vice President Mike Pence had the power to reject electoral votes on 6th of January 2021 during his purely ceremonial role as presiding officer of the U.S. Senate. The House recently approved a bill to amend the wording of the Electoral Count Act of 1887 to clarify that a vice president cannot stop the certification of the electoral votes and that their role in certifying the state results is merely ceremonial. Donald Trump wrote, "The vice president did indeed have the power to send electoral votes back to state legislatures for reapproval, despite the constant drum from Democrats that he absolutely did not." Trump added, "But they just put clarifying language in the disgraceful, ominous bill, making sure that a vice president doesn't do what they all said would not be done. So why the new language? Because it was just another political con job."
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about banking in this episode and the upcoming episodes, hopefully, or inshallah, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before we start our program, let's take a listen to a short biography.
Music.
little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasis, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. The topic is the Islamic laws about banking and financial matters according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Well, Sheikh Javid, you know, let me ask you this question. If the banking system, and in some countries actually it is the case basically, if the banking system is based on usury or riba, what is the Islamic law about using it for either depositing or borrowing money?
Well, there is no objection to depositing money with the bank under the title of, riba-free loan.
Mm-hmm.
It is absolutely permissible. And of course, there is no objection either in any in borrowing money from these banks on a riba-free basis.
Yes.
So as long as there is no riba involved, there is no objection in either giving money or receiving money from the bank. Now, if the borrowing is based on riba and it is considered a riba-based loan or a riba-based borrowing, then it is absolutely haram as a matter of religious obligation. And, of course, the loan contract per se is valid. You know, the act of receiving riba is forbidden, but the contract signed is valid because the contract is a contract. It's not loan. It is an agreement reached. So the agreement is valid, but the loan, the interest that you receive is not halal to use.
Sheikh Javid, if I procure money from the bank to fund a silent partnership venture, is it permissible to make use of this money to buy a property?
Well, the capital of a silent partnership is deemed a deposit with the recipient. It is a kind of deposit. So the recipient should have no right of disposal over the money except for trading in it as the contract between the two parties dictates, you know. So it should be, the money should be used in accordance with a signed agreement between the two parties. And if the recipient unilaterally spends the money in any other venue, of course, his action would amount to a kind of usurpation. It's a kind of unauthorized use of the money, and that's not permissible.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Sheikh Javid, a person received a sum of money from a bank for investing in a trade. It was agreed that the bank would be a partner and receive a share of the profits. If the business makes a loss, will the bank share the loss?
Well, in a silent partnership, as far as we know, the loss would be borne by the capital and its owner. The owner of the capital, the loss will be borne by the owner of the capital. That is what we know based on the silent partnership.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it would be made up by the profit also, you know, because the profit which is gained, and if there is a loss, the loss can be compensated from the profit that is made over time. So this can be made, and of course it depends also on the agreement reached between the two parties to the contract, because silent partnership is a contract that is reached between two parties, between the agent and the person who deposits money. And so there is no objection if the two parties actually conclude the contract with the provision or with the condition that the working partner sustain the loss wholly or partly. That's also allowed.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. The topic is still the Islamic laws about banking and financial matters according to the fatwas of Ayatollah Khamenei. Well, Sheikh Javid, you know, usually when people open savings account with some banks, it is stipulated in their agreement that the bank would give the depositor some profit or some interest on their money, the original money. What is the view on such a profit?
Well, if the money is deposited in the savings account as a loan,
yes,
while the transaction is based on interest, obviously it is interest, because Islam does not accept such a stipulation. The stipulation is basically forbidden.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not permissible to receive such a profit, because it is riba, it is haram, it is what we call usury. So usury is absolutely forbidden, even if it is a very small amount of something, some money or something that is considered to be an addition to the principal amount and the principal property invested. So usury in any form is absolutely forbidden. And it's not acceptable.
Mm-hmm. I see. Sheikh Javid, there are different plans or schemes as to investment with the banks. You know, there is one of them in which the customer puts some money in it on a monthly basis, all right?
yes.
in a deposit account for let's say 5 years untouched.
Sure.
At the end of this period, the 5 years, you know, the bank gives the depositor an amount on a monthly basis for the rest of their life or lives. What is the Islamic view on this issue, on this type of investment?
Well, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, this kind of transaction has no Shari basis. It mm-hmm. is invalid because it is riba-based and it's not permissible. So that's the answer.
I see. Okay, and how about this question? Maybe this is the last question I raise here in this episode. What is the Islamic view on a long-term deposit? A long-term deposit account whereby the money attracts profit calculated as a percentage?
Well, there is no problem in depositing money with the bank with the purpose of investing it in any of the Shari'i transactions. And I think I have been saying it during the past few episodes that as long as there is a Shari'i transaction like partnership, like Ju'ala, like silent partnership, which is called Mudariba, there is no objection and there is no problem in such kind of investment because it's permissible. And so the profit that is received by the investor is absolutely permissible. And there is not any problem in taking the profit and as long as there is an investment and of such type. But if the money is deposited with the condition that, the for example, the bank give him a certain amount of money, and this stipulation is made in the contract, and the depositor clearly and explicitly states to the bank that he wants the bank to give him a certain amount of money or interest on a monthly or on regular basis. So this kind of explicit condition is absolutely forbidden. And in the event that the depositor does not stipulate or does not place any condition, and the bank gives a certain amount of money to the depositor without any prior condition, without any stipulation,
mm-hmm.
then, of course, there's no problem in receiving the money. There's no objection to him receiving that money because there wasn't any condition in the first place. And the bank itself is giving some money to encourage that person. Maybe the bank might have deposited, might have invested the money, because usually the banks use the money to invest in some profitable projects.
Right.
They fund projects which are very lucrative, very profitable, and so there is no objection to receiving the interest that is given to the depositor mm-hmm. in that case.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Chabi. Thank you very much for joining us and listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.